his computer now. He's carrying it himself.
Lights on.
Well, welcome everybody. We'll call the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation to order for its first meeting of 2017 session. For the record, it is the first of February, and we have a number of things we're going to do today, members. We've got three bills up, and we have a report. But first up, we have the committee rules. These are the standard rules that you've seen before. So we're going to start off with the chair moves adoption of the committee rules as presented. We've seen them a number of times before. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. All righty. My agenda said introduction of committee members, but it's the same old tired committee we've had before.
Come meet the new committee, same as the old committee.
Same staff. We do have some new staff, though.
Oh, yes. So if you'd like, Mr. Chair, Nita Kumar is our committee assistant for this session.
Welcome.
She's a recent graduate 2015 from Willamette Law School. 2016, thank you. She's joining us for the session, Mr. Chair.
And misfortune of being assigned to our committee.
She will also be staffing the joint committee as well. So double the misfortune, Mr. Chair.
Oh, there you go. All righty.
Great.
Well, welcome very much.
Yeah.
Glad to have you with us. All righty. So we're going to, first up, we've got the we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 21. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 21. Provides authorization to the Oregon Board of Accountancy to disclose confidential information to certain public entities. It requires the public entities receiving the information to take responsible steps to maintain the confidentiality of the information. The measure has an emergency clause, and so it will become effective upon passage. We do have in hand, Mr. Chair, the statement of minimal fiscal impact and the statement of no revenue impact on the measure, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And do we have a sign-up sheet?
Yes, so I think we have...
We're still working on it. All righty, we'll just stand at ease for a moment.
Sorry about that.
Well, we could start off with the who's...
So it's the Board of Accountancy is here, Mr. Chair.
Board of Accountancy, if you'd like to come forward, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Welcome.
Whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martin Pitioni, and I'm here with the Executive Director for the Board of Accountancy, and I'm here with Board Chair Scott Wright, former Board Chair Scott Wright, to my left. And I'll actually, with your permission, let him go first for his testimony, and then I'll chime in for a moment.
Welcome, Scott.
Oh, thank you. Chair Senator Beyer, Vice Chair Senator Thompson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Wright. I am a practicing CPA. I'm a partner with the Eugene accounting firm Kernett Stokes. In December of 2014, I was confirmed by the Senate for my second three-year term as a member of the Board of Accountancy, where I just did finish my one-year term as the chair of the board. Thank you for allowing me to appear and to provide some testimony about Senate Bill 21. The purpose of the testimony is to give you a brief background about the Board of Accountancy and the proposed bill in front of you today. Executive Director Pitioni will spend more time on the specific language and operational impacts of the bill. The Board of Accountancy licenses approximately 8,000 CPAs, certified public accountants, PAs, public accountants, and municipal auditors, as well as about 1,000 public accounting firms. Our mission is to protect the public. It is a public protecting the public is a component piece of our statute, where the board will investigate complaints against firms and licensees, and then can take action based on the facts gathered as part of the investigation. The board opens between 40 and 70 cases in any one particular year. In 2011, the statutes regarding the Board of Accountancy were amended through the passage of House Bill 2067, which provided that The complaint process, which had been public, became a confidential process until a decision had been reached. The language was written in such a way that records were exempt from disclosure while the investigation was going on. The bill itself didn't have any opposition. But it did not anticipate one piece, is that it failed to recognize the ability for the board to cooperate with law enforcement and other state and federal agencies while they might be doing some sort of investigation. Therefore, the Board of Accountancy, we're here today and respectfully request that you adjust that small piece of the statutes dealing with our Board of Accountancy through Senate Bill 21. In our view, the board's view, Senate Bill 21 removes that hurdle of the board in accomplishing our mission to protect the public. With permission of Chairman Beyer, I'd like to turn the time over to Mr. Executive Director Pidione, who will give you some more background on it, unless you happen to have some questions for me.
Okay. Much go ahead.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee, I will simply, for the record again, my name is Martin Pitioni. I'm the director for the board. I simply want to focus on a couple of pieces that you should know about the bill in terms of language and operational impacts. In essence, all this does is focus on the confidentiality provisions that only apply during the pendency of an investigation. And if we have someone come in, whether it's law enforcement, regulatory entities, that ask us for information that is currently under that confidentiality veil, that we actually can release both records, that's one piece of it, as well as information. And essentially that actually covers a little bit more. It means that we would actually have permission if an investigator comes in from one of those entities or from law enforcement, that we could actually have a conversation about the case, impressions about the case, which is covered by the broader term information. That said, this bill is crafted very deliberately in a very narrow fashion. All it does is, if you look at the first three words in the bill, is all it does is essentially refer to an exemption from ORS 673-170, which is where that confidentiality provision exists. And the reason why I have that specifically in written testimony, and I want to specifically address it in oral testimony, is that I want to as clear as possible as part of the legislative history, that this is not some kind of a blanket override that the board could release confidential information that's held otherwise confidential in other parts of law. And in the bottom part of my written testimony, you have one example as to why that's important. The board is one of two entities, the other one being the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners, that has a specific arrangement with the Oregon Department of Revenue that we can receive confidential taxpayer and tax return information from that entity. There are very specific provisions that apply to that, including we can't re-release those. This bill doesn't change that, the way that's written. And I just want to put that really clearly on the record in terms of why it's drafted this way and why it's as narrow as that piece is. With that, I think I'll stop. The rest you have, I think, out there in the written testimony. And with your permission, I'm happy to open up to any questions for either me or board member Scott Wright.
Okay. Thank you, man. Members, questions? Senator?
Of course, I have a couple. Can you give us an example? I'm trying to figure out what type of information you're trying to get at. I mean, I understand for the purpose of this section, a public entity is a board or agency of this state. Fully get. But then you drop down and you're talking about district attorneys, the Department of Justice, the law enforcement agency of this state. So I'm trying to understand what type of information we're really trying to get at through the Board of Accountancy. Show me how that could apply to a district attorney.
So, Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, it's deliberately written pretty broadly because you can't anticipate all the circumstances that may occur. It is written and modeled after actually a statute that applies to the health regulatory boards, which have very similar language in there right now, and that you're probably familiar with, as I think, as a licensee of the dental board. So it's essentially the same concept that applies over there applies over here. The way that would play out practically is that there are times when, quite frankly, investigations that may not be primarily about what the board investigates, but involve one of the people that the board has records on, whether it's licensing information or investigatory information, that have some kind of an angle into what that other entity is investigating. And they will come in and they will ask us for it. And that actually has happened. And it does not necessarily have to mean that the person that we're dealing with is necessarily either the primary target of whatever they're investigating. It could be a side angle. We don't know. But we have had, including federal entities, come to us and say, hey, we're looking into XYZ. We can't tell you what we're looking into specifically, but we really would like to have essentially any and all information you have on this individual, including any pending complaints and complaint investigations that are going on. And then, quite frankly, as a regulatory board, you want to be in a position of releasing data to them, even if they're not in a position to tell you exactly, you know, what they're looking for or whether that's even relevant to what they may be looking at. They will determine relevancy essentially once they get our records. I hope that that's, you know, addresses your question at least in some way.
Okay. I'm good.
Anybody else? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right, I have two people who have signed up that wanted to comment on this. The first is Mark Connect.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for allowing me. I don't know why. I just got this stuff in the, here this morning. I'll sit down here.
Sir, could you put your name on the record, please?
Yes, my name is Mark Connect, and I live here in Salem, and I do a lot of advocacy work for veterans and people with disabilities, such as my friend Ralph back here. And maybe I'm ahead of myself here, but last session, the transportation bill failed, and we desperately need transportation in this community. For a capital city, we could have a whole lot better transportation system than what we've got. And I realize that the federal government has to divide the money up between 50 cities. Okay, but we still need transportation. When money got tight, Chariots had to cut bus service on Saturdays. Yeah. And so we desperately need some kind of way to pay for that. And I know you're looking for solutions, but it's not going to be easy. But us people with disabilities and people that do not drive cars and so on, they depend solely on public transportation.
Mark, I appreciate what you're saying. This particular bill doesn't deal with that at all. This is the broader transportation issue. That actually will start taking that up at 5 o'clock tonight.
The Joint Committee on Transportation. Got to go to church tonight. So
okay.
Will there be another time where we can come back?
Absolutely.
And testify?
You bet.
All right. Thank you for your
time.
Thank
you very much. Appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
Ralph Gordon.
I think Ralph is with him.
Ralph is with him? Yeah. Okay.
I'm here.
All righty. Same issue, huh, Ralph?
Same issue.
Okay. Well, this is this bill doesn't directly deal with that. And so I heard the comments.
I'm in the same boat. I mean, there are a lot of us that need transportation. We don't want to wait forever to get it. We want to get it now. There's a lot of us disabled that have to depend on our family members, and our family members don't have the time to transport us around.
I get it. I hear you. That's one of the issues that we will be taking up as it's a different committee, but we will be taking that up. It's one of the major issues.
Some time for testifying again, we'll be back.
All righty. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for coming down.
It'll be on February the 6th, I believe.
Is that right, February 6th?
That's what it says in the book here.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Sounds good.
No, it's on Monday.
On Monday?
Thank you.
All right, that's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Senate Bill 21.
Seeing none, we will close public hearing and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 21.
Mr. Chairman, I recommend we...
You move.
I move. I recommend that we move.
Well, you just
I'll
move.
Get the wording down. I'm just going to move? Well, that's your job. Okay. I move Senate Bill 21 to the floor with a due pass.
There you go, Senator.
Very good.
Thanks.
The Vice Chair has moved Senate Bill 21 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
I think he should carry after we gavel.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 21 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we will close on that bill, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 67.
And do you have a carrier on that bill, Mr. Chair?
He did such a good job that I think we're going to let Senator Thompson carry that.
Oh, great.
One.
Oh, thanks. Oh, thanks.
Initiation as Vice Chair.
Yeah. No. I think we just load up the Vice Chair.
All right, Mr. Chair, let me...
you didn't say that last session.
No, we didn't.
I carried a bunch of bills last session.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 67 makes a few definitional changes to statutes related to real estate. It also clarifies language related to the system for registration and renewal of business names for businesses regulated by the Oregon Real Estate Agency. It exempts certain checks from the requirement to deposit funds into clients' trust accounts, requires real estate licensees to notify the agency of certain activities related to clients' trust accounts, and the measure also prohibits certain individuals from sharing compensation paid to the real estate licensees. This measure comes to us with no fiscal impact and no revenue impact, Mr. Chair, and has no subsequent referrals and no amendments.
Thanks, Patrick. Mr. Bentley.
Chair Beyer, Senators, my name is Gene Bentley, for the record. I am the Real Estate Commissioner for the State of Oregon. Senate Bill 67 is really the outgrowth of a lot of activity that we had at the Real Estate Agency starting about a year and a half ago, and it was to tune up ORS 696 and go through and see if there was anything that needed to be changed. We convened a group of individuals who were both licensees, members of our advisory board, members of the Oregon Association of Realtors, industry members, a legislator who also happens to be a licensee, Sal Esquivel, the BAM analyst, and the LFO analyst. So we had some 28, 29 people involved in this group. It took us about 6 months to kind of go through everything. We met and went through all of ORS 696 and made modifications to it, most of which were housekeeping in nature. There were a couple of changes where we added to some information. We added information on client trust accounts as it stood in the existing language now. A real estate licensee must, if they handle funds, run it through their client trust account. And the client trust account is there so that if there is ever a litigation where they have a finding against the licensee, the client's money sets in a trust account which cannot be used to fulfill the responsibilities of the licensee. And what we did was we changed that, or we're proposing to change that, so that if an individual handles a check from a buyer or a seller to the other party, made out to that other party, they don't have to run it through their client trust account, because all they're being is a courier for that check, taking it from one party to the other, and it's made out to somebody other than the licensee. The other thing that we did also was deal with real estate licensed real estate property managers who are doing activity. Brokers and principal brokers, our primary licensees, can do property management, but we also have a third license that is property management licensee, and they can only do property management. And we wanted to further make clear the restriction that they cannot go out and deal with tenants for properties other than those properties for which they are the property manager of and have a property management agreement with. So those are some of the two major changes to it. Other than that, they were mostly housekeeping in nature. We had a former license category called a sole practitioner, which was an individual who had been a licensee for a minimum of 3 years and operated by themselves. That license category was folded into principal broker, which is our supervisory level brokerage license, and some of the language in the ORS 696 still made activities capable for a broker, which is the entry-level position, and that entry-level position needs to be supervised by a principal broker. So we made all of the corrections in those bills. So most of it is housekeeping in nature. Once we had a final version that was acceptable to the work group, we went out and talked to people in the industry around. I made some 29 different conversations with groups and individuals, and so far we've had no pushback on it. I believe that you'll find behind me a couple of individuals from the Oregon Association of Realtors. They are supportive of the bill, so that's the short version. I can go into longer, but somehow I don't think you want me to.
Well, questions, members?
Hi. Sean Cleve, is he going to come up and are you going to testify?
I'd be happy to.
Sure.
Chair, by our members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sean Cleve, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'd like to publicly thank the commissioner and the work that the agency has done on the statutory rewrite. It is exceptionally boring, but probably overdue. There was some cobwebs that they dusted out. I think the provisions that they made are reasonable, but for the record, at this current moment, we are neutral on the bill. That's only probably more a function of when our government affairs committee meets. You scheduled this very promptly. I do appreciate that, but we don't meet until next Wednesday. I'll be happy to come back after that time and tell you our official position. I would expect it to be in support, though.
Hmm. Okay. Question?
No, I just have a comment before
okay.
we vote on the bill.
Well, let's wait.
I'd like to
Any
wait.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 67? All righty. We'll get a motion on the floor. But we've got to close the work session.
Can we close
the public
hearing. Can we go into discussions first?
Sure. Well, we'll open a work session and you can do a discussion.
Yeah. If they haven't really got this bill is a housekeeping bill, and I tried to read through it. It gets technical really quick. There's a lot of there's three definitions in there that, it's a total rewrite of some of the laws. And I would actually like the realtors to come back with a yay or nay. We haven't had a chance to review it yet. So is there any chance that we can just review it?
Senator Beyer, Senator Girard, just to illustrate the amount of work that the commission has done in including our members, I believe there were over 35 brokers that were part of the work group that did develop this. That group isn't necessarily reflective of our governance structure, though. So I hate to sound exceptionally bureaucratic on the beginning of the hearing today. Our chair of the Government Affairs Committee that would review and give the thumbs up, neutral, or thumbs down on this was on that work group. I do appreciate Senator Girard the pause. I would hate for that to be a roadblock if the committee sees an opportunity to move this forward. But it is the first day of session as well. I just don't want to be an impediment to moving forward based on probably a formality at this moment.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm good.
Anything else? We are in work session.
Okay. I move Senate Bill 67 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 67 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion on the bill?
Glad to.
Don't see any. Is there any opposition to the bill? Seeing none, Senate Bill 67 passes to the floor with a do-pass recommendation by unanimous vote. And
Thompson wants to carry this one. Thompson does, because I want to ask him some questions on the floor.
And we can provide those questions. Bill?
Sure.
Riley will carry. We will close.
I won't really answer.
And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 68.
Senate Bill.
What do you want me to give you? Rundown,
for the record, my name is Gene Bentley.
Gene, just hold on a second. Let the staff do an introduction.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The measure modifies fees related to real estate and escrow activities under the jurisdiction of the Oregon Real Estate Agency. We have, and you have been provided with a copy of the fiscal impact statement for this measure. We have received a revenue light for this because it's got a subsequent referral, Mr. Chair, to the Committee on Ways and Means. So should the committee take action on this bill, it would go to the Committee on Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Now, thank you for waiting.
Good afternoon, Senator Beyer, senators. For the record, my name is Gene Bentley, Real Estate Commissioner for the State of Oregon. Senate Bill 68 deals with our fee structure for the agency. We convened a group that I had mentioned earlier of people from the industry, people from the board, people from the legislature, and specifically Sal Esquivel, who is also a licensee, the LFO analyst and the BAM analyst for the real estate agency. These individuals were part of the group that also looked at the structure of 696, but in specifics in this bill, they looked at the fee increases that were necessary to sustain the real estate agency for this coming biennium. We have, over the last three or four bienniums, been working through a reserve amount that we had that amounted to some $3 to $4 billion that was run up in the heyday of real estate back in 05, 06, 07. We peaked in number of licensees in August of 07 at 24,607 individuals. We have subsequently run down. We are now at, hang on just a second, I need the number.
21,000.
We are now down at, we ran down to the low point in October of 2012 at 17,965. That was a loss of some 6,600 and change, or about 27% of our total licensees at the time. Fortunately, we had the reserves that we had built up in the time, and we have slowly but surely worked our way through those reserves. We estimate that now at the end of this biennium that we will have reserves in the amount of some 363,000 and change. That's the estimate for 6/30 of 17. That will give us about 1.3 months worth of reserves. LFO and BAM indicate that a typical reserve amount should be somewhere in the 7, 8, 9 month range. We had that when we had our some 3 million reserves, and that was in the 2009-2011 biennium. We have raised the fees about 30%. Currently, the major fees that we experience are the application to become a licensee and the renewal to become a licensee. Today, that is $230 every 2 years. We're proposing to raise that to $300 every 2 years. That's about a 30% increase. As I mentioned earlier, it's been 20 years since we've had our last fee increase. The general feeling, I think, in the industry is, while they would just assume we didn't have a fee increase, they recognize that in order for us to continue to operate the way we are, we need to have a fee increase and to be able to do so. To put it into perspective, individuals who are realtors currently spend about somewhere in the $450 to $550 per year to be part of that organization. Our annual cost, if it went up to $300 per biennium, would be $150 annually, so if that puts it into perspective. I'd be open to questions.
Questions? Any comment, Sean?
Chair Beyer, member of the committees, for the record, Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Similar to Senate Bill 67, the commission and Commissioner Bentley have done an exceptional job in outreach. I know that the commissioner has spoken to our governance structure no less than three or four times over the last year regarding the fee increase. I think generally, our governance structure recognizes that there is a need for a fee increase within the agency. The illustration, to build on the illustration from the commissioner, they're a other funds agency, so they are funded primarily upon fees. The run-up in 2017 of the number of brokers in Oregon meant that there was a large reserve fund, which the agency has been able to use very strategically for a variety of programs and services that our members do appreciate. However, at this time, we are neutral since this is a fee increase, and I think that there are some members that of ours that want to be a little bit more familiar with it. In this particular case, perhaps expediting to Ways and Means would be something that my governance structure would appreciate. That's not to say that ultimately we won't come in and be advocating with the commission for the passage of this bill, because we all do, as agents, rely on not just the licensing system that the agency provides, but a variety of services and really kind of the public safety side of the real estate market. So. With that, I will conclude and provide any answers to questions that you might have.
And my understanding is that your budget is in front of Ways and Means a week from Friday?
I believe it's on Thursday.
Thursday? Okay. Questions, members?
So we need to move this.
Yeah. I have a comment.
Comment?
I used to sit on Education Sub, and we deal a lot with that. And LFO goes into that in a lot of detail, and I mean they review it, and we're not capable of doing that here, so I have no problem bumping it up to Ways and Means. I would like to do it with no recommendation, so they come in with a clean slate.
All right, well, thank you, gentlemen. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on this bill?
Sal's here.
Sal, do you want to comment on the fee bill? Excuse me, Representative.
You think I should get up here first?
You're out of practice.
It's either now or you're just do down Ways and Means.
You have to watch these guys. They are real personal. Sal Escobar, Representative District 6, Medford, and I just wanted to let you know that I was part of this, and I really appreciate the fact that we've done some good work on it, and it's a fair fee bill. It's fair.
Okay.
I, as a realtor, don't have any problems with it whatsoever.
Good enough. Any questions of the representative? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. That's a good way to do my testimony. Thank you, sir.
Once again, does anybody else wish to comment on Senate Bill 68? Hearing none, we will close the public hearing. We will open a work session. And the chair would move that we move Senate Bill 68 down to Ways and Means with no recommendation, since it's essentially a budget matter, and that's their bailiwick. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 68 is passed down to Ways and Means without recommendation. And we'll close on that.
Mr. Chair, I'll take good care of it.
Senators, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Monroe, I'll look forward to seeing you a week from Thursday.
Appreciate the work that you've done. Clearly, you've done the outreach and have people involved on both of those.
That's what they pay us for.
There you go. That's what I like to hear.
That's usually the way.
We are now going to move to the last item we have, which is an informational meeting, and we're going to invite up Paul Mathers to give us what I think is going to be probably what is the winter storm report. I was thinking it was the other bill, which is there. rebalancing of the safety. But that's next week. So we'll just do winter now. And Paul, since you've had a lot of practice, are you? I understand you're going to get some more practice on Thursday.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Howard Division Minister. Yes, just got a weather briefing this afternoon before I walked over. They're expecting freezing rain here tomorrow afternoon, evening, lasting mostly through the day on Friday. Obviously, as you get closer to the gorge, more severe. Conditions in the gorge will likely stay in freezing rain, snow combinations through Saturday. So, so here we go again. Yeah, it's just been one after another, and then they mentioned the S word again on Monday. Yeah, so we'll see where all
turn 84 into an ice skating rink.
Oh yeah, they've done that already.
So before we get ahead of ourselves here, I thought I'd spend just a minute talking about a few of our projects, as I usually do, hit some highlight of some of our major projects. I have one kind of innovation I thought I'd share with you of things that we're up to, and then spend most of the time talking about our winter operations and what we've been up against the last couple of months. I can't help but start with Pioneer Mountain Eddyville. Again, it's been part of my presentation to you for, I think, every presentation for about the last 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to do one final note on this. The highway is open, as I said it would be.
It's a great highway.
Fall of 16. The new alignment is open to traffic. We still have additional work to do on the far west end on the existing alignment, but the new alignment is open. And really receiving some pretty rave reviews from people that travel this corridor, Corvallis to Newport, taking 5 to 10 minutes off their hour-long trip. It's significant improvements from a safety standpoint and a mobility standpoint. Project had its problems, for sure, but it's turned out to be the benefit that we anticipated to be from a safety and a mobility standpoint.
Paul, I wanted to tell you that, one, I've driven on it. It's great, and I think you're being conservative in the 5 to 10 minute savings. I think it's a little more than that. At least that's what I've heard from people who travel it a lot. Perhaps they're not traveling at the speed limit, but that's what they say. The other thing is there's a lot of truck traffic that's starting to be much more again now, so...
That's
that was
correct,
one of the
Mr.
issues.
Chair.
We used to have the paper pulp trucks used to have to go around through Lincoln City and down.
We actually,
they can do the straight shot. Now it's in doing wonders to keep that business operating in Toledo.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we had a restriction on that highway where we could not have long trucks on the highway, and now those restrictions are removed. And, eliminating that through Lincoln City and others has been very, very helpful. So just moving on to a couple other kind of signature Jobs and Transportation Act projects. One, again, I've talked about and given you background on, just a quick status report on the Newburgh-Dundee project. Here's a photo of the south end of the project. That's Dundee that you see in the picture, the new alignment that's nearing completion and where it ties into Highway 99W. They're south of Dundee. Hamilton Construction has this phase of the project. Here's the north end of the new alignment, again, rapidly moving towards completion. This alignment will be open in the fall of this year, so we're probably 8 months, 7-8 months away from opening this new alignment. That's the Newburgh end. The highway there in the very bottom of the picture is Highway 219 and where it connects. So now I'm going to pivot on that intersection. That's the same 219 new alignment intersection. The final phase, which is under construction, is by K&E. K&E contractors out of Salem. They're improving Springbrook existing highway, existing city street connection back to 99W, and that will serve as the northern leg until we have funding to do phase two. Phase two will take off from this point. You'll notice I can do this with my arrow here. So this connection in where the new alignment comes in, this is actually going to be the future on-ramp of the new interchange. So the new interchange, if you can visualize, will sit right in here. The new alignment will go through here, and it'll be a diamond interchange, and this will be the leg of that new interchange. So as that goes through, the new alignment back to 99W will take off through this area. The final phase of this current construction that we have funding for is a realignment of Wilsonville Road. You may have heard over the last year or so some controversy about that as we moved towards construction. There was concern about how that was going to be connected into the bypass. So we're going to use savings on the project and put Wilsonville Road into its final configuration for the project, and it will be connected to 219 actually off the bottom of the picture. So that's work that still will need to be done in a separate contract. But the new alignment, the three major phases of the project will be open to traffic this fall.
Do you have any information, Paul, on how much the opening of that has increased truck traffic over to the Aurora interchange?
Well, we don't have, Mr. Chair, we don't have it open yet. So when it opens,
well, I mean just the phases that we have.
Yeah,
there.
So that's what I would anticipate. I don't have an exact number, but I would anticipate you're going to see a lot of truck traffic come down I-5, hit the Don Aurora interchange, go over on a county road, hit 219, and then hit this bypass. That'll be a very popular, I think, route for tours to the coast as well as truck traffic.
When we were out there, when the joint committee was out there, that's one of the things that we've heard a lot from people is that it's a lot of the stuff that used to go through Salem to go on over the coast is now diverting to this.
Correct.
Creating an entirely different problem. Yes, Chuck.
Is this going to have any effect on that light to the north there, the one right? If you go to the north of that, yeah.
So this is 219, and
right.
Then it connects to 99.
But there's a light right...
Right here, there is a light, yes. So the temporary north connection will be on Springbrook, which is where this light is here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're making improvements on Springbrook today, and it'll connect to 99W. So if you're coming from Portland and you want to use it on 99W, you'll make a left at Springbrook.
Okay.
There by Fred Myers.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll come down Springbrook, make that light you're talking about there at 219, jog over, get on there. That'll
Got
be
it.
The connection that will be used.
Okay.
Senator?
My question has to do with the Wilsonville Road. I'm not familiar. What are the plans for the Wilsonville to Newburgh Road you were addressing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, so we're not making any improvements to the broader Wilsonville Road. It's just its connection here.
Okay.
So the concern was that the way it was, we went through the planning process, the EIS, it was all shown as that Wilsonville Road would just make this simple connection right here.
Okay.
As we got closer to completion of construction, residents got concerned that people were going to use that to get to I-5.
Jeez, I wonder why.
Yeah, so.
I already do.
So do I.
So we're going to make that. We're going to put its connection not lined up with the end of the with the new bypass.
So they're going to leave it the way it is.
Okay. Well,
not
the way,
to encourage
the way it is today,
it
connects back here to Springbrook
right.
The way it is today. So we're not going to leave it this way. We're actually going to move it the other direction on 219. It'll actually connect off of 219 back towards I-5 in its final configuration. The problem is these two intersections are too close together to handle the volume of traffic that's going to go through there.
Right, right.
Okay, I got you.
I understand.
Okay.
Highway 62. So this is in Southern Oregon, in Medford. Some of you on the tour probably had a chance to see this project.
Mm-hmm.
Medford is just off the bottom. I-5 is just off the bottom of this picture where Highway 62 connects to I-5. If you're familiar with the area, it's the Costco, Walmart area going north there on existing Highway 62. This utilizes the old Medco Hall Road alignment and provides a bypass around that area. Again, like we did in Newburgh, we divided this up into two separate contracts to provide competition for Oregon contractors. Knife River was the local contractor, was the successful bidder on the portion from Vilas Road, which is here, from here south, and they began construction this summer. If you were out there this summer, that's the work that's going on. We just opened bids on the northern half of this alignment. Knife River was also successful on that, so now they have the entire contract. Here's a couple pictures I'm going to show you are of this interchange right here. That's where the bulk of the work has been going on so far. Here's some of the work from this summer. This project is two more construction seasons yet before it's complete, so it'll be the fall of 18 is when this will be complete. One relatively simple, but I think showing the use of technology of how we can improve capacity with existing signals and existing roads. This is in Lincoln City. If you've ever been in Lincoln City in the summertime, know what a challenge that is getting through that community. We looked at these seven traffic signals. If you're familiar with the D River, it's right there in the center of the picture. The seven signals on either side. Took a simple piece of software and put that into the controllers in each of those seven signals. If you think way back, traffic signals were set on a fixed timing. They work yellow, green, red, just at the same time every day, and maybe one change. When we got more sophisticated with our controllers, we were able to change those to an AM peak and a PM peak timing. What we did with the software is allow these traffic signals to talk to each other and allow them to adjust their time in real time based on how traffic is operating. What we found was we were able to see in the southbound direction about a 23% reduction in travel time in that corridor, and northbound about a 5% reduction in travel time. So not a huge savings, but a significant difference where if you're in the community, especially southbound, you would notice a difference in those heavily congested summertime months. So we learned a lot in that. We'll continue to refine that, and we'll be able to hopefully apply relatively inexpensive software at about like $2,500 per traffic signal type of software that we're able to implement. So moving on to winter storms. It's been very challenging, really, and really the most heavily hit area has been in eastern Oregon. They started with some major snowstorms towards the first half of December. If you remember here locally in the Portland area, we got kind of our first big storm here in the valley around the middle of December. Northeast Oregon in particular has been in this. If you looked at Northeast Oregon today, City of Ontario at one point had 4 feet of snow. I think they're maybe down to 3 feet today. But there's 2 or 3 feet of snow covering everything you see in this map, maybe outside of downtown Pendleton today. Challenges for them has been just the amount of snow, but then when it's not snowing, the wind has been blowing. And they've been fighting 10, 15-foot drifts, and they've been plowing literally the same snow over and over again, trying to keep roads open and keep roads operating. I want to show you a quick video of just kind of what it's been like. So this is kind of a side-by-side comparison. If you're driving down I-84, this is one day compared to the next. And people wonder why we closed the road. Yeah. While there hasn't been a wreck, when the road looks like this and you can't see where you're going, these are the type of conditions that they've been fighting on a fairly regular basis, and have a number of closures in that area. So just give you some appreciation. We posted that on some of the social media just to give people some idea why we've got the highway closed when we do. These are the type of situations we're trying to prevent. When we have these kind of accidents in those kind of conditions, we have people stranded, we have people in an accident, we have emergency responders trying to get to people in those type of situations. So again, closing the road and preventing these from happening and preventing people from being in a life-threatening situation. Here's some of the snow around LeGrand, just in the valley there, and us trying to open the road, some of the high drifts. We took our snow blower that's typically in the mountains. It was in the small town of Union. Wow. Trying to open city streets and blow some of those city streets open. And this was taken before the last couple storms, so this isn't even necessarily the worst of it. So it hasn't been just in Northeast Oregon. This is actually on the coast in Curry County. You look at that picture and you probably think you're on Highway 97 or something somewhere. This Wow. is actually just north of Port Orford. So it really has, this winter has really affected virtually every corner of the state. One of the challenges we've had is actually with social media. So here's an example where we've had closures on I-5 at the California border. Either when there's problems in California or we have problems, we hold each other's traffic because there's not good places to have people spend the night. So it would be in Ashland or down in Redding. We do that on a fairly regular basis. But in some cases, and in this case it was with Apple on their apps, they kept the closure in place long after we had it open, and we kept calling them up and asking them to take that off of their app because people were going down forest roads, they were going up the ski road, they were trying to get around this, and we were getting people stuck. Finally, we took to social media advertising this and I think got their attention to take that off of there. But this is the type of situation that we're up against when we close the highway. So here's a picture in California down by Redding. This is taken on one of their cameras about 5 miles behind the closure. This queue of trucks goes 5 miles further than this. We have about 10 miles, three lanes of freeway, solid trucks, which is a challenge of itself. But then also the bigger challenge is when you open that back up, you better be ready to receive that amount of trucks, not just, say, in Ashland, but in Grants Pass and Eugene and Salem, because you will notice even here in Salem, 8 hours after we open in Reading, you will see a significant amount of trucks still traveling, you know, through I-5 through the state of Oregon. Same thing in 84 when we have closures through the gorge and so forth. We have to have good places to stage trucks and keep, and it's important for us to talk to Washington, Idaho, California, and then ourselves as we open and close highways and release the massive amounts of traffic. Central Oregon has also been affected. Here's a picture of our regional office. In Bend, 2 to 3 feet of snow there in Central Oregon. So much in Bend, we actually had to hire a private contractor to help load the snow out of the urban areas. We ran out of places to put the snow in fears of if we had a melt also that we would have some flooding concerns in the area. The biggest challenge is probably from a media standpoint, and I think what you've probably heard most about is our challenges in Portland stemming back from in December when we had a relatively small snow event, 1 or 2 inches of snow, but timed perfectly almost with the evening rush hour. We had congested freeways where we weren't able to get our equipment out. We had drivers that weren't prepared for those conditions, and that was a combination that really turned into a very seriously safety issue. We had children on school buses till midnight, people stranded for hours on the freeway. This is not the situation that we want to be in. It really puts that community in a very vulnerable situation for any kind of life-threatening emergency where you need to get to a hospital or fire trucks need to get to an emergency. So let me just talk about some of our practices and some of the things that we're doing to improve our efforts and enhance our efforts around snow removal. So traditionally, our snow methods are plows, our sanders, our blowers that we have. Sanding rock, our liquid de-icer, mag chloride is what we use. What we call, and then chains and traction tires are restrictions that we put or expectations we put on drivers to be out there. Several years ago, 2010, 2011 timeframe, as we've seen traffic patterns change, we see drivers change. As you know, and you saw in that picture from California, the freight system that we have, the reliability on our supply chains are so dependent on just-in-time delivery of trucks, highly dependent on the roads being open and passable. And if we have closures for any length of time, it really has a very big economic impact as well as a safety impact on our roadways. So we began thinking we've got to change our methods. And one of our methods is should we break from our past tradition of not using salt and start using salt. So we set up a pilot starting in 2012 and looking at two different sections of highway, one in the far southeast corner of the state, Highway 95. It actually goes between Idaho and Nevada. Both those states use salt. And so when you're traveling on that road in Idaho, typically you're on bare pavement. Hit Oregon, you're not. Go back to Nevada and you are. And so that expectation for drivers change. Same thing in California that uses salt on I-5 over the Siskiyous. You're on bare pavement, hit the state line on the pass, and you're on different conditions, whether it's pack or ice. So we tried to see if we could learn how to use salt, integrate that into our other tools, finding a way to alleviate those transition zones in those two areas. So here's some of the results that we've seen so far. We set up a 5-year pilot. This is 4 years into that pilot. In I-5, we've seen the crashes reduce from an average of 115 per year during the winter season down to 45. Mm-hmm. On US 95, we've seen those crashes reduce from 75 to 50. On I-5, we have what we call holds or closures that I talked about. Those have been reduced from an average of 36 per year to 3. And we also have chain restrictions that we put on going over the Siskiyous, and those have been reduced from an average of 48 to 11. And those numbers are going to change with the severity of winter we had this year relative to the last few, but likely there will still be significant reductions that you will see in the benefits that we've seen in using salt in those pilots. We're also keeping observation from an environmental standpoint. We haven't seen impact in these areas with vegetation. We're really concentrating on trying to use the least amount of salt as we can and have the maximum benefit of that of salt. We have detected some elevated levels of chloride in one stream on the siskiyous. We're not sure if that was a pre-existing condition because we've been using mag chloride, which also has chlorides in it, on a fairly heavy level for a number of years in that corridor. So we're still monitoring that and looking into that. And we haven't so far seen any impacts to our roads or to our bridges. What we're trying to do is minimize the use of really any one of these materials, all of them, whether it's sand, whether it's mag chloride, the liquid form, or whether it's salt, all of them have negative impacts on the environment. But used in the right way, in the right combination, we think we can have some pretty dramatic results on our system. We're trying to use, especially on salt, we're trying to target those storms, like we've, for example, the one we just saw here locally where we had a snowstorm, ice storm, and then stay cold for several days later. Those are the types of storms where salt can really help us when we don't have a tool to deal with that. On a typical winter day where we have rain during the day, as it tapers off, temperatures cool down, and then we get black ice, we get spots of ice, freezing fog, The liquid mag chloride works great. We can use just a little bit of that, pre-treat the roads, and it works great. It's when we have, say here locally, four or five times in a bad year, those major storms, and we really need to add a different tool to our toolbox to help us be more effective in using salt.
No, yeah, I think it's more of a comment, but I lived in British Columbia, and they salt their roads up there, and I have to tell you, it takes a heck of a beating on your own personal vehicles. And so I think when we're doing a cost-benefit analysis, you need to factor in what the long-term effect is on vehicles.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, that is something obviously we're paying attention to. The amount of salt that we're talking about using in our climate is very different than British Columbia, is very different than Ohio, very different than Wisconsin. We are going to use far less salt, on the order of 10 to 20 to 50 times less salt, just because we're in a different environment. Plus, we're going to be very conscious about the amount of salt we use with these other tools that we have, and trying to find the least amount of product, whether that's a liquid mag chloride or a solid in salt, trying to find the least amount of product that we use to put down to receive the maximum amount of benefit.
Okay.
So here's a little bit, just a diagram to illustrate where those two pilots are. If you look at the green on there, those are where those two pilots are. As I said, those pilots are in their fifth and final year of our pilots, and so we're asking ourselves, where do we go next? You see some pretty dramatic results from travel. The areas in orange up there are kind of orange is yellow. Those are the areas that we would target to go next, where we see in those other summits in southern Oregon, where we see, again, a lot of exposure and a lot of use of a lot of winter conditions where salt would be very valuable to us, and then again in northeast Oregon on I-84. To get set up to use salt in these areas, it's expensive. We've got to spend $10 to $15 million to build the salt sheds, to get the right type of equipment, stainless steel liners in our trucks and so forth to use it. The salt itself is very inexpensive, but to get set up to use it right and use it responsibly is an investment. And frankly, is an investment that we're going to need in our capital construction side of our budget. And for those of you in Ways and Means, there's a discussion we could have at that point on whether that's something that that should be in our budget to expand to these two areas. The areas in blue are areas that don't receive snow at the level in orange. But if we were in a situation where we were set up in a pilots in the areas that we expand into, we would have a lot more resources than we have today. We'd have a lot more availability of salt and equipment that if we did have a winter like we are having now, we'd be able to move resources around like we do today and apply it on a broader scale in the interstate. Here's what one of those sand sheds look like. This is the one in Jordan Valley that we have. It's hard to tell in the picture, but those are concrete walls that are lined liners that does not allow water or the salt to penetrate into the groundwater. Here's an application of salt. It's kind of interesting to look at this. The lead truck up here, you see in yellow, is actually putting down sand. This truck here is actually putting down the liquid de-ice material, or the mag chloride, and then we have the salt. You can see the stainless steel liner that this truck has. What we have found is that actually using the combination before the storm really starts, you can see this, there's not a lot of snow yet on the roadway. If we can put down that combination of liquid and solid together, as the snow builds up, we can work our way through the storm, and then that peels right back up again as soon as the snow stops, and we're right back down to bare pavement. That's one of the kind of techniques that we've kind of perfected in these two pilots. Oops. Oh, I want to show you just a couple of photographs. Here's I'll show you on my screen. But here's a photograph of area that we use salt on Sylvan Hill on 26. Just taking from our traffic cams, we use it on the uphill side and did not on the downhill side. You'll notice that the downhill side there in the very fast lane there is some bare pavement. That's probably just from the spray coming over from the other lane into that lane. That was enough to help reduce the ice in that area. Anyway, some background on our winter operations.
Great. Questions, comments? Senator?
We weren't able to help the onion farmers in Ontario. Unfortunately, that's a crisis. As you well know, the sheds have collapsed under 3, 4, 5 feet of snow. And a lot of those businesses over there, the biggest onion farming place in the world, I understand, are perhaps even going to be out of business. I don't know. It's not your problem, but boy, it is a problem.
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, no, but we have been helping out local communities. The City of Ontario, we've been working with them extensively to help dig out their streets and using our equipment where we can. To help them out. It's been an unprecedented winter over there. Some of our employees have lived over there all their lives, and they've never seen it like this.
Yeah.
Well,
my concern is similar to Senator Girard. I've got relatives in British Columbia. I visit them quite regularly. Their vehicles, if they're more than 3 or 4 years old, are all rusted out underneath. Salt is corrosive.
Right.
It'll almost be a last resort, I think.
Yeah, if you look at Washington, Washington's been using salt for a number of years. So is California, so is Idaho. Just the climate that we're in here in the Pacific Northwest doesn't call for the use of salt near to levels that you do in the Midwest or even in Canada. You don't see rusted out vehicles like you do in the Midwest or maybe in British Columbia, in Washington or other places, and those are areas where they have been using salt for years.
Yeah.
I suspect part of that is that you go to the East, I'm more familiar with the East Coast.
Right.
And that's because they use it on all the city streets, so the cars are getting a lot more of that.
Mr. Chair, yes, and they just use, I don't have the number off the tip of my tongue, but we have a number from the City of Indianapolis. In one storm, they used 100 times more than we have all winter long. So they use it as their primary and sometimes exclusive way to clear roads, where we use sand and de-ice and other materials to try to keep our roads
clear.
What
we're seeing in eastern Oregon is kind of a typical winter.
Yeah.
More? Patrick, I think we hit the end of the agenda.
Yes, we did, Mr. Chair.
We did. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, we are adjourned.
Good.
Anything else for the good of the order? If not, we are adjourned.
Good.